And now, Talk Radio 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with your hosts Richard Musio and Joe Vecchio. Now, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I am your co-host, announcer, and producer, Joe Vecchio. Welcome to you. Welcome on this beautiful Sunday night. We're having such terrific weather, and I'm really enjoying this time change. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour, CPA and family office advisor and friend of many and running enthusiast, Richard Musio. Richard, good evening. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Hello, everybody. It's nice being able to drive over here in the daylight.
That's for darn sure.
Because for about 4 months, we couldn't do that.
And we're launching into our spring weather, and it's, well, it's always great in San Diego, Southern California, but can't complain.
Yeah, and we've always been accused of being in the dark on this show, so people can't say that anymore. Now we're doing it in the light.
Yeah.
In the light.
How about a quick reminder about April 29th, when you and I are going to be together live at the Doubletree Hotel in Hazard Center after a great screening of Third and Long, that great documentary about African-Americans in pro football. So we'll get more details on that later, but looking forward to that.
That should be a – oh, I've – looked at Teresa Moore's website, and that's going to be a great movie. That's going to be a great event, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, we'll only
say
have,
the least.
We'll only have Hall of Famer Ron Mix there in Abner Haynes.
I saw Abner Haynes play football when I was about 6 years old.
Is that right?
Yeah, here in San Diego. He was playing for, I think, the Kansas City Chiefs.
Flying in from Texas for this, for us.
Good.
And I think we might have Bill Walton there, another Hall of Famer, not to mention Teresa flying in from New York, so the filmmaker herself. So anyway, just a little deal like that. Let's get to today's show. We've got a really special guest. And full disclosure, this show is pre-recorded because our guest, we could not, we've got to get these great guests when we can get them. So don't try calling him. But Richard, why don't you introduce tonight's guest and we'll get into it.
Yeah, and people were wondering how come we haven't talked about how the Aztecs did in basketball. It's because the show had to be pre-recorded because Katie's in town today and... Anyway, go Aztecs. Hopefully it'll be good news by Sunday, and they will have won two games. Katie Klingsmith, UBS. Again, UBS, our major sponsor of this show. Drew Frates, Michael Coranta, and the crew. But we've got a really, really special guest, and we're going to talk about some interesting things. And that would be Katherine Klingsmith, but she goes by Katie. And she's also 7 months pregnant. So in case you start hearing screams or something, and we have to deliver on air, that's what's going on. But I, I know what to do, so don't worry. My second child was born 2 minutes after we got to the hospital. I thought I was going to be delivering my second child of three on the side of Highway 5 about 19 years ago, and I was ready.
Wow.
But I was glad I didn't have to. But I still remember what to do. So don't worry, Katie, we've got you covered. Katie's with UBS, and no pressure there, but... she's with the research team or the research group of what's known as UBS Wealth Management Research. And she's got a fascinating background. In particular, we're going to talk about this. She previously worked at the Federal Reserve Board. And, of course, there's been some interesting news coming out of the central bank this week that we're going to talk about. And she's also an expert on, well, a lot of the economic aspects of foreign policy and lots of interesting news coming out of there as well. So, Katie, welcome to the show. And we always love to start with one of our guests just by talking a little bit about your background. So besides the fact that you're pregnant, nobody knows anything about you.
I think I'm pleased to not have you be my obstetrician.
I know.
But beyond that, let's talk about it.
Exactly.
No screaming yet. We'll try to keep it together over here.
So tell us a little bit. How did you get to where you get? Because you have got a... I don't want to read your bio because that's not that... I want you to tell us about how you got to where you got because you've got a fascinating background.
Goodness, the winding road of life. I got to say, I've always really liked economic policy and I first was more interested in it as a concept. You know, I wanted to know what made people rich and always very interested in the international element. So I spent a bunch of time living in some poor places trying to figure out, well, you know, why are these places poor and what do people have to do to make some money? And somehow that ended up eventually leading me to markets. Yeah. Here we are.
But can we get started at the very beginning with your education? I mean, I thought Andy Blocher had a great education. I mean, this is, if you could just start with Swarthmore and take us through, I mean, this is terrific stuff here.
Well, I promised you beforehand I had to get in that I grew up on a farm in Oregon. So my education started with public schools, mm-hmm. being bussed into little farm schools in Western Oregon. But that's right, I went to the East Coast for school. I went to Swarthmore, tiny little Quaker school in Philadelphia that tends to be a rather nerdy and eccentric and I think pretty cool institution.
I heard 1,500 students. That's amazing.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Not very many
And
of
they
us.
Were pro-abolition and pro-women's rights.
It was
in the 1800s.
It was the first school to be founded co-ed. Mm-hmm. Very first one in the country.
1864.
You did your homework. Or if you knew this already, I'm really impressed.
No, I just watched Jeopardy a lot. No, I did some reading.
Nice job.
I've got family back there, so I've seen the Quakers many, many times and visiting relatives.
You know, the sports team is called the Fighting Quakers. Does that make sense to you?
I know. Yeah, well, it's an oxymoron, right?
There's something wrong.
It's an oxymoron. It's like the Fighting Buddhists, the Fighting Quakers.
No.
But anyway, Swarthmore, and then your concentration of studies was in which areas?
Well, I was interested in history, but really quite interested in Latin America and Europe. And that, between in college and after college, led me to spend a fair amount of time abroad. Mm-hmm. I think we have all these conversations about globalization. It's nice to be able to start that from one's education. Mm-hmm. So I spent a chunks of time in Central America, chunks of time in Brazil and Spain during college, and then after college, a couple of years in both Portugal and Argentina.
Now, when did Harvard University come in for your master's?
After that, it's how do I get back to the U.S.?
Wow.
I've been dilly-dallying around in these places. Fascinating. But so I was actually working for a commercial bank in Argentina and thinking that maybe I wasn't going down the academic route, was more interested in the markets and economic policy. And so went to the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. So did master's in economics there.
Macroeconomics and international trade and public policy and all that. And then Fulbright Fellow. How do you get to become a Fulbright Fellow?
I'm sure I wouldn't be one today. But, well, I was pretty academically oriented, so it really was more for folks thinking about, you know, getting a doctorate. And well, I think I, at least for myself, made the better choice. It was more doing that academic research. And once I got started on it, I realized it was more where the rubber meets the road, where all those economic ideas affect markets, affect money, that to me was the most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like back the best, that was your work experience, because in addition to the Federal Reserve Board, you've worked at the World Bank, as well as at a commercial bank in Argentina, and in a microfinance organization, which to me is fascinating, because microfinance in my world sort of combines working in the community or philanthropy with economics.
Absolutely. Thinking about how markets work, I mean, hopefully for the wealthiest of folks, but also for the least wealthy of folks as well.
Mm-hmm. Where did you work in the microfinance organization? What country? Was that down in South America? Or
I worked for an organization called Acción, which is the biggest of the microfinance networks in Latin America. So I was actually in Cambridge. That's where it's based. I was working in their headquarters in the capital market side. It was a really interesting nexus, just as you say, you know, where all those things, all the market stuff and the economic development, you know, making better opportunities for folks, where it all comes together.
And we're also doing some other events with Katie Lai while she was in town. Again, this show is pre-recorded because of her travel schedule, including one event that we're doing at the University of San Diego, my alma mater. Mm-hmm. And Joe, you were very kind to set that up. Can you tell our listeners briefly what that is?
Well, you mean the school or the event today?
The event today at the school.
Well,
University of San Diego is a college. Most listeners know that.
Yeah.
Joe.
Well, okay. It's your alma mater, as you said. You know, you graduated there in 1980. I contacted the director of the center, the Ahlers Center for International Business, on Friday, and even given the fact that the students were still on spring break, she said she'd see what she could do to establish an event for us today for Katie. And inviting faculty, students, et cetera, administrators. And I thought they'd only get maybe 5-7 people. I think they're close to 20 now. And we'll be over there at 2:30 afterward in the Manchester Conference Center in the boardroom.
It's going to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
I can guarantee you.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the challenge was we were on spring break last week. I didn't even know that. I was wondering why it was so crowded at the beach.
Not the weather.
Nobody was in school. So, Kitty, we're going to talk a little bit about some foreign policy issues, but I know there was an announcement out of the central bank this week that's really, really important, I think, for us to start with.
Oh, the central banks all over the world making all sorts of decisions right now. What does it mean that equity markets all look pretty cheerful, but there's still these huge threats? So, yep, the Federal Reserve just came out with their announcement. We've been hearing a lot more from the Fed in general. They've got these new policies of much more Fed speak, much more communication. But the formal announcement from the Federal Open Market Committee was made earlier today, Tuesday, and recognizing that things are a little bit better, they basically are changing their language, saying that economic conditions are turning up a bit.
But what do they, I mean, oh, that's a technical term, turning up a bit. What do they exactly mean by that?
I don't know if it's a term of art exactly from the Fed. But they talk about how labor market's a little bit better, economic growth looking a little bit better, and some of the big risks really starting to fade.
Okay, we're going to talk about that when we come back.
Yeah, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs.
Just broke, growing friends.
All right, we are back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. And if you'd like to reach Richard, get on his website, iymoney.com, iymoney.com, and over to Richard now to thank some sponsors.
Again, big thanks to UBS, our major sponsor, who's also here in studio. Katie is also accompanied by Michael Coranta, who's with the private wealth management team that includes Drew Frates and Mike Kaniger. We're not allowing Mike to speak on air, but he's going to get a chance in the future. And so very, very big thank you to UBS, as well as our other sponsors, Rich Gaines and Family Legacy Legal, the CPA firm of Polito Epic, San Diego's finest audit and review firm, Don Epic and Paul Polito CPAs, and of course, the inimitable Carl Sheeler at Business Valuations Limited. Thank you, everybody. So, Katie, before we went to break, we were talking about a technical term, which was that things are looking up a little bit. So more explanation, please.
That's right. We heard from the Fed this Tuesday. And I think a lot of folks even a month or two ago were talking pretty seriously about the Fed doing even more to try to prop up the economy. And you know, we've come a long ways. There's still so many threats out there in the global economy. But in the U.S., it seems like we're actually starting to create some jobs, 6 months in a row of job growth in the U.S. And the Fed is recognizing that. So while they're still telling us they're going to keep interest rates at very low levels, likely for another two whole years, they're probably at this juncture not going to be pursuing those additional, what they call quantitative easing, additional insertions of money into the economy.
Can I ask a quick question about the international central banks and the U.S. central banks? How much synergy is there between those entities, or how much competition? Do you have an opinion on that?
Sure. It's pretty interesting. I don't think there's normally that much coordination. I think most of the central banks, they're not explicitly in competition, but really they're thinking about what's going on in their own economies. For little countries where their economies involve a lot of trade, they care more about what's going on in the rest of the world because the rest of the world affects them more. Mm-hmm. The U.S., it doesn't matter what our trade policies are. We're such a big country and we spend so much of our money on services that actually what happens abroad is not necessarily as important to us. Now, that's not an ideological statement. That's an economic statement. Mm-hmm. It's just that we don't do as much trade as the little countries. Mm-hmm. So normally speaking, countries, I think their central banks are operating fairly independently. These days, we've once again seen a fair amount of, I wouldn't call it coordination, but very similar action across central banks as a lot of the threats, the very nature of the threats is global.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I guess maybe a question with the Federal Reserve. Didn't they do a lot of helping out of banks all around the world when all this crisis was hitting the fan and probably still is a factor? But
you got it. Absolutely. I mean, part of that might be some effort at coordinating a global response to global problems. Part of it also is because a lot of those global problems had to do with problems in U.S. dollar markets, even when those dollar markets were more about what's going on in Europe. So, for example, European banks who had loans in U.S. dollars. Well, guess what? The European Central Bank doesn't have any control over the dollar. So for them to be able to help their European commercial banks, they needed to have dollars. So the Fed kind of needed to step in because a lot of the kind of nexus of the problem was a U.S. dollar, U.S. financial system. Of course, we've got plenty of news coming out of Europe right now. But again, the Fed had that role because of the importance of our economy and the nature of the financial crisis.
So can we talk about Europe a little bit? I know a few days ago there was, maybe you'd call it a policy inflection point. I guess five central banks got together. That would be what, the ECB, New Zealand, I think England, Canada, and Australia would be the fifth. And I guess there really was not much action that came out of that. I know they basically decided to say the same thing, to keep low rates on hold. And it may be because some of the uncertainties of late last year are starting to be not nearly so uncertain. Can you comment a little bit on what happened with when those five major banks got together?
Absolutely. So they're all making their decisions independently, right? So not not exactly coordinated, but we have this trend across the world of central banks still worrying about, we're going to call it downside risk. That could mean anything, but gas prices are going higher. The situation in Greece is anything but resolved, even if it's not headlines this week. There's plenty of sources of fear out there, but that things aren't looking as scary as they were a few months ago. So we have central banks just keeping rates really low, but not moving. Various reasons for that, but that's exactly right. All of the many meetings that happened last week, every one of those big central banks exactly on hold. We had another one this week besides the Fed. We had the Bank of Japan as well. Everybody just keeping steady.
So is the contagion in Greece under control or not, in your opinion?
In the short term, yes. But let's not forget, Greece defaulted. And at the end of the day, nobody cared that much because we were all expecting it. But if we had anticipated what occurred last Friday, a year and a half ago, markets would have been crazy 18 months ago. It's not a pretty outcome. It's just that we had so much time to process it and that European policymakers ultimately got us prepared for what would be a default. Contagion, I'd say under control for now. Great big questions about what's going to happen with Greece and with Europe still wide open and here to haunt us.
Yeah, no, let me just recap what happened. And those of you who don't read newspapers or online, I guess in terms of the numbers this past Friday, I guess about 85% of the bondholders in Greece participated in their debt swap voluntarily. And the target was a 53.5% haircut on the face value of the bonds.
When they say haircut for the average person, that means they just wrote off 53% of their debt, or the
That's right. Wow. And, you know, voluntary is kind of a term of art here. I don't think anyone voluntarily says, yeah, I lent you $10. Please just give me a little less than $5. Mm-hmm. It was a long, drawn-out set of negotiations between those people who had those private bonds, the Greek bondholders and the Greek government. They said, okay, well, if we don't voluntarily, and again, I'd love to put that in some quotes on the air, reduce the amount of money we're going to get back from Greece, we're not going to get anything at all. So we need to get together and say, let's do what we can so that Greece has a lower debt burden so that we get something out of this deal. And then Greece in the end was able to get enough voluntary participation that they were able to use a fine legal maneuver to force nearly everybody to accept the same, you know, haircuts, just accept the same lower amount of money than they were originally expecting.
So do you think Greece is on a sustainable debt path?
No, sir.
You don't think so? Nope. Why do you say that?
The goal here was to get Greece to have 120% of debt to GDP. That means that just over the entire economy's output for a whole year, 120% of it is the amount of debt they were allowed to carry. This is, in the international community, often assumed to be the maximum amount of debt a country can manage and eventually bring down without the debt just getting so big that the interest payments alone drive it up. The problem with Greece is that there's no growth going on. Their economy shrank by almost a quarter, almost 25% over the last couple of years. You've got to have growth to pay back anything at all. And we just think a lot of the assumptions around Greece going forward are too optimistic. Nice goals, but just a little too peachy of an outlook to really think that we're gonna see them realized.
And so do you think that's going to play out over 6 months, 12 months, 18 months?
Greece alone, we think easily in the next 6 months, they're going to need some more support. But that's just talking about Greece.
So how did Greece get in such big trouble? How did it happen?
You look at Europe in the first place. I think we have to remember that the European Monetary Union, the euro, it was originally a political project. This was a project to avoid war in Europe. Now, we're not talking about Greece. We're talking about World War I, World War II, France and Germany. Mm-hmm. And there are all these economic structures that were built around making that political project successful. It wasn't primarily driven out of economic logic. Lo and behold, we've got a set of countries that are so different than each other, all using the same currency, same interest rate. I mean, I think about it. What would happen if Mexico, the United States, and Canada had the same currency and the same interest rate? Well, I'm not making a political comment. I hope it doesn't sound like an egoistic comment. The United States would have more weight in that discussion because we'd be the vast majority of the economy. But Mexico, totally different needs, much poorer country. Mm-hmm. It's growing faster, as it should, because it's more of a developing country. Canada, maybe similar level of wealth, but they export commodities. Their economic cycle cycle's totally different, yet we'd have to have one size fits all. That's what's going on in Europe. And if you look at really any of the measures, Greece and maybe Portugal, but Greece clearly at the extreme, no coincidence here, is in a very different state than any of the other countries. That was true 30 years ago. It was true 100 years ago. It was true 30 years ago. It was true 2 years ago. And it's true today.
So that credit, that CDO situation, that Greece probably would have happened anyway without all of that.
In terms of credit default swaps?
Yeah.
So sooner or later, all the politics involved, Greece just was on an unsustainable path. And just one note here, Greece, the government itself was overspending during the last 10 years. Some of those other countries in Europe, it was more about private credit. In Greece, it was more about the government spending a lot of money.
All right. Well, with that thought, we've got to take our long break now, but we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money Not Theirs after news, sports, and weather. We're back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs with Richard and Katie and a really great show. Welcome back.
Joe, you wanted to clarify one point when we came back, so ask your question again.
Right. Well, my question was derivatives and all that crisis that was caused in 07, 08. How much did that impact Greece and all these other countries as opposed to the euro situation in and of itself?
I think we're still dealing with this fallout of a huge amount of leverage. Everybody leading up to 07 and 08, they just wanted to make some money. It was greed before really thinking through what they were buying. And that's the issue that was about subprime. It was the issue about emerging markets. And it was the issue about Greece. Mm-hmm. People were lending Greece money at the same rate or just a couple of basis points more than they were lending Germany money. They thought of those countries as being the same credit risk. And it's not that anybody ever actually thought they were exactly the same. It's that we wanted a little bit of yield, and so we were willing to go for it. So I think we're still, you know, there's lots of politics, structure, history, all that to the specifics, but we're still dealing with the consequences of what we call the great deleveraging. We're still dealing with the financial crisis.
I wish you would have got to John Corzine a couple of months ago or more than a few months
ago. That was
ago.
Back in October.
Yes.
Oh, like.
MF Global, yeah, I know. It's not even in the news anymore. That's the scary thing.
I forgot what happened to John Corzine. I don't know what happened to John Corzine.
It's better that way.
Yeah, it's better if we don't know. So I'm going to ask a little sort of a two-part question. Trade imbalances. I know there was some news a couple of days ago where you might say that the U.S. trade balance deteriorated above a, was it $50 billion? I forget what the target figure was. And it was the worst in some time. And we also have this issue in this country on energy and energy dependence. At least, in my opinion, two things sort of go together. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, trade imbalance, you know, it's always two parts. It's how much we're importing and how much we're exporting. Unfortunately, we import a lot of energy. And so a good portion of that imbalance is the oil, paying for the oil that we bring in from abroad. I would note that the exports from the U.S. weren't that bad, though. So the trade imbalance itself, it's a problem. And we have to think about with whom, with which countries we have trade imbalances. There's all the political ramifications. But we are also seeing signs of growth. So there's a little bit of good news in those numbers as well. And again, as you suggested in your two-part question, energy is a big part of this. With energy prices so high, and with the U.S. importing about half of our oil, we are certainly paying the costs in terms of the trade balance.
Well, could you clarify? So there's a lot of buzz on the internet as to, you know, the root causes of why we just had this recent spike in oil and gas prices. And I seem to have read that domestic oil production is up 11%. Consumption or demand is down. Do you think this has anything to do with the speculators or the futures markets being non-transparent or not transparent enough? Or
I think the big issue is the concern about supply. So what we really looked at, and we just did some analysis on this, is when energy prices run up because everybody thinks the global economy is booming or about to boom, so there's going to be a big demand for oil. Well, that's a good thing. I mean, it might not be a great thing for us filling up our cars, but it tends to coincide with more job opportunities, with everybody seeing bright horizons, everybody in terms of not just U.S. demand, but global demand. Unfortunately, both in terms of actual economic growth and expected economic growth, it looks like this run-up in oil prices is all about concern around supply. Mm-hmm. And that's, we can talk about, is that speculation, is it not? It's kind of hard to know what motivates individual contracts. But it's pretty clear that there's actually drops in supply from certain countries in the Middle East. So still dealing with Tunisia, concerns about Egypt, which is more transportation.
Syria's having a lot of trouble.
Syria, absolutely. And then, of course, the big one is Iran. Mm-hmm. So even though we haven't imported oil from Iran for a while, it's basically, I mean, between the two types of oil, it's still basically fungible. It's a commodity. Mm-hmm. And if we got Iran offline, or even if we got more worried that Iran was going offline, meaning there was an actual military conflict in the Middle East, we'd see an even bigger spike in oil prices. So a lot of what we're seeing is that worry.
Mm-hmm. But now, as far as futures trading, though, that movie Inside Job, there was a lady in there, Brooksley Bourne, who ran the CFTC, the Futures Trading Commission. She got into some headbutting with Larry Summers because she didn't think it was right to deregulate the futures, because now you can't. It's not transparent. You really can't see who the big players are in terms of taking large positions in oil futures. So I don't know if that's changed or not, but it was a concern in the film.
Good film. If you haven't seen that, you should see that, listeners.
Won the Oscar.
So while we're on foreign topics, let's talk about BRICS. Brick by brick. Now, how about Brazil, India, China? I know some news that came out of Brazil earlier this week, a little bit of disappointment in their GDP number. I think the growth was only 2.7. We've got so many notes here on the desk. So I saw some commentary describing that as somewhat disappointing. But again, Brazil, India, China, these are the growing economies, so to speak. And just love to know what you think about the news that came out, for example, on Brazil's GDP.
Hey, we still think emerging markets are going to grow a lot faster than the developed world, but there's clearly some signs, very clear signs, in a lot of those countries, including China, that growth is slowing. Now, growth is slowing from very high rates, and it's still pretty positive in a lot of places. I mean, the other news out of Brazil was that last week they actually cut their target rate. The central bank cut interest rates more than anybody expected, showing that there, again, is some concern, even though there's still all this demand for emerging market assets. There's concern for the economy is cooling down a little too quickly. We think that we're going to see a soft landing in really all of those countries. We're not looking for any kind of real economic collapse in the big emerging markets, BRICS among them. But it's something to watch closely.
And how about Russia? What's going on over in Russia?
A little election.
A little election. That's one way to put it.
If I can just expand on that question really quickly, one of the things we're looking for this year is that nearly half of the GDP and population of the world is going to see new leadership this year. The elections in Russia, obviously elections in the U.S., elections in France, elections and unplanned political transitions just account for so much of the world's population right now. So elections in Russia, certainly important. Russia economically is doing pretty well because they export oil and gas, and oil especially, as we just discussed, is looking pretty good. That helps everything in Russia. The state's pretty big. A lot of what buys political support in Russia is exactly those petrodollars. So we think it's a politically extremely difficult place in which to invest, but from a GDP perspective, better off than some.
And an easier place to invest, but I'm going to ask about it in the context of what you think is going on there. The United Kingdom, much more developed country than Russia. I know I was reading some summaries of what happened there, and I guess the news is very, very mixed coming out of UK as to whether things are good, bad, or indifferent.
Such an interesting place to consider relative to the U.S. too. They dealt with and are dealing with the same problems we did. Huge exposure to the financial sector, housing prices that actually went up even more in the U.K. than in the U.S. And lo and behold, they responded very differently. Government implemented pretty intense austerity. So they cut spending everywhere, where clearly that hasn't been the route yet politically in the United States. And lo and behold, even if the U.K. they didn't have any of their bonds downgraded, they're looking pretty stable. It's not a fun place to be. I mean, we have manufacturing still very slow, consumer confidence still very slow, house prices still very low, unemployment still quite high. There's not the indication that we're going to see another big downward dip in the UK. But, I mean, just last month, the Bank of England, their central bank, announced additional quantitative easing. If anything, things are harder in the UK, at least in the short term. Maybe they're taking the medicine now than they are in Europe, or at least in Germany or in the US.
Yeah, and I heard from a friend who owns a business in the UK, if you think money's hard to get out of banks for a business loan in the US, he said you ought to try getting money out of a bank in the UK right now.
Yeah, credit conditions awful.
It's horrible credit conditions. And so I tell people, look at the bright side, you could be in the UK.
Or Greece. I don't know
or Greece,
what you're
exactly.
looking for.
Yeah. Well, one question we asked this of Andy as well. Now let's say if you were president, what could a president or what could our government do to stimulate some of these companies that are holding so much cash on their balance sheets to invest it back into the economy?
Gosh, yeah, it's such a hard thing for a government to be able to do that. I think more than anything else, clarity around regulations and taxes is going to make it more interesting for companies to do it. It's not so much how to twist their arms. It's clear companies are sitting on a ton of cash, mm-hmm. and they're not even doing mergers and acquisitions, which is normally what they, you know, besides paying dividends, normally what you see when they've got that kind of liquidity in their balance sheet. So I think it's the uncertainty that's holding them back. Instead of twisting their arm, it's make it clearer for them how to invest.
Look at Apple. I mean, the shareholders are screaming for a dividend. I mean, right? Richard?
Right. Dividends used to be for old people. And now it's everybody wants their dividends.
Cash is king. People
anyway,
want their dividends.
Oh, unfortunately, we have to take another short break here, but we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money Not Theirs with Katie and Richard. Oh, boy, that's a new one. We haven't heard that in a while.
What is that, Joe?
That's the Tonight Show. You know, Paul Anka wrote
that. Right.
And
Paul Anka.
We're back with more of It's Your Money, if you hadn't figured that out yet. But Paul Anka gets a residual on that. Probably not for tonight, but he used to. Anyway, welcome back. Richard, take it away.
Katie Klingsmith with UBS is our special guest. And been a fascinating show. And I forgot one country. I didn't bring up the word Japan. And I know... I guess it was maybe late last week, the yen weakened. I guess it was last Friday. And I'm not sure if that's going to be major news or minor news. I think I do a ton of reading, and some people said that's huge news, and other people said that just isn't going to matter.
Oh, the yen's quite the bugger. I mean, we've heard a lot about Japan this past week or two, of course, commemorating 1 year after their disaster. It's a sad thing. And interesting to note how they're recovering. The economic growth has been, you know, pretty decent because they had a lot of reconstruction to do. The yen is a curious currency. It tends to be one of the lowest interest rate countries anywhere in the world. And that means when people are in the business of taking out loans and using that leverage to invest other places, the yen tends to get cheap. So it's called carry trading. People, again, borrow in yen and then go invest someplace else. And that's mostly what we're looking for. If we see global financial markets start to do a lot better, not our current short-term view, but if we do see people ready to take on a lot more risk, we're probably going to see a much weaker yen. In the meantime, this partly reflects that risk-taking. It partly reflects that the Bank of Japan is still keeping interest rates extremely low, and they are the absolute champions of quantitative easing. You think there's a lot of money in the U.S.? There's a lot of money in Japan.
Is the Bank of Japan serious about keeping inflation at 1%?
So they announced that target just earlier this year, and we actually had Tuesday, the first meeting of the Bank of Japan since, you know, they've been implementing that target. They do seem pretty serious about it, and markets are taking it fairly seriously, even though the Bank of Japan has been in the business of looking for some inflation for, gosh, 15 years. It seems like this is a pretty credible goal. If they get there, who knows? If they're going to work towards getting there, seems pretty clear.
Okay, now let's switch gears, because Joe said during the break, we need to talk politics. Right, Joe?
Yeah, well, a lot of people are interested.
We have an election coming up in this country.
Hard to avoid.
You know, Katie, you made a really interesting comment before the break about the uncertainty in the tax arena. You know, granted, we would rather have a 15% capital gains rate than 20 and a 35% highest marginal rate than 39.6. But I found that the real issue with people with money and businesses with money is the grotesque uncertainty of not even knowing what the tax rates are next year. If we could have, for example, a 10-year certain time frame, whether tax rates on capital gains are 15 or 20, if we knew for 10 years what it was, we could do a heck of a lot more than we're doing right now with our planning. And I think cash would start freeing up because people could rely on the answers.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think people all over the political spectrum agree with that. Anybody focused on how to create economic growth would agree that businesses need to be able to plan. And if they can't plan, how are they going to hire? How are they going to begin major capital investments if they don't know what their tax rates are going to be? And I think this translates just squarely into why dissatisfaction with Washington is at record highs. Well, dissatisfaction at record highs, satisfaction record lows. It makes this election a pretty interesting and in some ways pretty dismal affair.
Well, Congress, anyways, not in great favor these days. But
and the presidency, too. Yeah. Both are are not so hot in the American population.
Well, also at the break, we asked, going back to 07, 08 and what the corrective measures and remedial steps the government took, the Fed, the president, TARP under Bush, and then the Obama stimulus package, which both created some, good deal of debt. What is your opinion? Did we avoid a depression? Was it money well spent, or jury still out?
Well, I think we're going to have thousands of PhD dissertations written about just that question. My own view is that what the Fed did in terms of, they were the ones who could act especially quickly in terms of bringing interest rates all the way down to zero, getting a lot of money out there, doing a lot of emergency lending, as we were talking about before, too, getting some of that liquidity overseas as well. To me, that was huge. Mm-hmm. What the federal government did, I think in the end, a lot of it's going to be seen as constructive. We can compare it to places like the UK. We were talking about that with Richard earlier, where they didn't do that kind of stimulus, and they're finding themselves mired in really a very deep mm-hmm. recession. Keeping debt better controlled, but very deep recession. Mm-hmm. To me, the challenge now is not getting too addicted to those levels of stimulus and mm-hmm. thinking about them as short term to get through an economic crisis and dealing with some of the long term structural questions that are keeping this deficit at 10% of the economy.
Mm-hmm. And then the, what was it, $16 trillion that the Fed lent out in microloans or several thousand? Is that money that's coming back, or where is that money these days?
In terms of the Fed, it comes right back. It's okay. All short term. So The only money that's actually out there in a more longer term capacity is what's on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. And that, we're getting in the $2.5 trillion range. That's used to be around $1 trillion. I mean, that was the stable level for a long time. It's a lot of money. But as long as there's still a lot of people looking for work, so we're not getting real wage pressure, and as long as that credit mechanism, maybe not as bad as the UK, but still not so convenient in the U.S. to get credit, most of that money is just sitting there in reserves at the Fed, so it's not producing short-term inflation risk.
Okay.
I know you can't give investment advice on the air, but we obviously have a huge election coming up at the end of the year. Do you think that's affecting how investors are investing here in this country with regard to their asset allocations and the decisions they're making? I mean, do you feel that people are still sitting on the sidelines because there's so much uncertainty about where this country might go with regard to its economic policy, depending on whether we have a re-election of President Obama or a Republican candidate gets elected?
Absolutely. We have done a lot of research on if there's correlation between certain parties being in power and outcomes in markets. If anything, the relationships are surprising in that it's actually under Democratic administration. So Democratic White Houses, we've seen better equity performance. Probably totally coincidentally, Democrats seem to start with markets that are cheaper. And so you could say the Democrats get elected when times are bad, or simply that's coincidence. If at a minimum, there's no clear outcome that will produce economic success. I would say, per your first question in this segment, that the lack of clarity around regulation, around taxes, around the deficit and debt longer term is a big drag on business in the short and the long term.
I did see a quote once, though, I think in a book I read in high school by J. Pierpont Morgan, and he said, well, if taxes were 99%, we'd still find a way. So interpret that any way you'd
like. I actually believe that, because I know some pretty high-powered tax attorneys.
99% for who? Well, believe it or not, the marginal tax rate for individuals in the U.S., we're at close to a record low over the last 100 years. Now, no political statement from me, but 90% was something we saw for about 10 years in the U.S.
Yeah, in the 50s, right?
That's right.
And we sort of missed one asset class. I have a lot of clients who tend to invest in this asset class, real estate. What's going on in here, and what are your viewpoints about the upcoming election and the real estate? Prices have been down. Is that an opportunity for buyers? It's going to continue. Obviously, tax policy could have a significant effect if we're not allowed deductions for mortgage interest or if capital gains rates get increased.
Yeah, absolutely. We're already seeing in broad real estate markets, if you take out the distressed sales, we're seeing house prices creep up a little bit. We don't think that we're going to see overall increases in house prices. This is on the residential side for probably another year or two. And that's with a whole set of assumptions. But those assumptions in part rest on what does happen in D.C. We don't think the mortgage deduction will go away because it's just too politically costly. What could happen, and this was part part of the deficit reduction plan that we had a year and a half ago. It didn't go very far, but some interesting ideas. Taking that maximum amount of mortgage down from $1 million to $500,000 certainly affects some people, but at an aggregate level, a lot less painful to implement. We think we're going to have real estate prices still being a big part of our overall economic story, and probably not a big bright spot for a couple of years, but stabilization is likely in our future.
And boy, that $500,000 would kill people in California. But I think we're about out of time. Michael Quaranta of UBS, thank you for arranging. Katie Klingensmith of UBS. Yes. Mm-hmm. Katie and Baby to Be, the baby's first radio show.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for listening. Richard, thank you. Have a great week. We'll see you next week on It's Your Money, Not Theirs. Good night.